For more information on ancient dragon Zengate and Taigen's teachings, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please click on the link for Just Give on our website.
So Ben Connolly is here to talk about his new book, Inside the Grass Hut, which is actually the Song of the Grass Hut, which we just chanted, was written by Shuto or Sekito, who lived from 700 to 790. I am fairly certain that this is the first book-length commentary ever written about this text. And it's a wonderful text that has not been appreciated sufficiently, although I think it is in this sangha. And so I really appreciate Ben writing his reflections on the lines from the Song of the Grass Hut. So welcome, Ben. Thank you.
Thank you, Taigen. And what a delight to be here. Some faces I have never seen. It's kind of amazing that I'm sitting here next to Taigen and I'm the one who's going to be talking to me, because I have read a lot of books, some of them a few times that you have written, and they have really inspired me. And you know, I wouldn't have this book if it hadn't been for the translation of the Song of the Grass of Hermitage, which originally appeared in Cultivating the Empty Field. That somehow came into the regular practice liturgy at Minnesota Zen Meditation Center, and there I encountered it. And I sort of stumbled into writing this book about it. I just loved it. So one day I just thought, I'm not a writer. I didn't really think about like I'm a writer, I'm not a writer. I'd never really written much. But I just thought, I have this computer and I could write words about this amazing thing that I love so much. And that just sort of flowered, I guess. And, you know, I wanted to write about this particular poem for a few reasons. One of them is, relative to a lot of Chinese Zen literature, it's comprehensible, moderately comprehensible. So, you know, people have asked me, who know nothing about Zen, when they hear about this, someone said, well, how's the poem go? And I can recite the poem, and they have some sense of what I'm talking about. Which, I don't know how long ago was the last time you guys first sat down and chanted the Heart Sutra, but if your reaction was something other than what is going on, then you're different than me. I wanted to meditate, so I went to Minnesota Zen Meditation Center about a dozen years ago, and I just sat, and then at the end they started chanting, and I thought, well, I picked up that the practice had to do with just doing the thing that was being done and just sort of giving yourself to it. Somehow I picked that up pretty quickly. So while my mind was thinking, I have no idea what is going on. This text makes no sense to me, you know. Who's Avalokiteshvara? What's an aggregate? You know, and so forth. Is that like something to do with coal mining? I don't know. So I was confused. I kind of got, so I'm going to feel how my body feels when I do this, or I'm going to notice how my, you know, I'm like, oh, I don't like this, not knowing. I picked up that was really the point, much more than being able to say, oh, I get what the Heart Sutra is about, and I can explain this line, that my momentary experiential relationship to what was happening was the point. But... and I can also say that there was one line in there, there's no attainment and nothing to attain. And I got that. I got that because I was tired of having to attain things. It's painful to go through life always trying to attain. And that came as a relief. Oh, here's a different kind of message. I'm not going to try and be a better whatever I am. I'm just going to do this. So I got that, but most of it just made no sense whatsoever. And I kept chanting, and it has never made any sense. Well, at some point, I could say something about it that would be comprehensible, but It took quite a while. And I mean, the Heart Sutra is by no means the least penetrable. Well, how about this one? This gem from the Gateless Gate, it's about the fifth koan or something. Why has the red-bearded barbarian have no beard? You can jump in. So, which actually, I have had delightful engagements with that koan and other people. So there is something beautiful. It's not like this Chinese literature is without merit or wonder or profound value for promoting human welfare. I love it, and I respect the fact that it's trying to do something that it can't be done necessarily through simpler means. But Shitu extraordinarily touches upon the same themes of this literature in a way that someone just encountering it can hear. Relax. Does everyone get, after lunch I relax and enjoy a nap? I get that. I got that right away. You know? Let go. Open your hands. Just walk. Steady practice. Simple themes. Simple living. So there's this extraordinary accessibility of this text. But, you know, when I think, I'm kind of a, I guess I'm, maybe I grew up like I'm a snob. Am I a snob? Well, you know, when I hear accessible, I think, oh, yeah, was that like Britney Spears or something? So the thing is, it's no less profound than anything else in this amazing body of literature that comes down to us. It's larded with allusions to many, many different Buddhist teachings. And not only is it full of this allusiveness, but it also creates a space with its openness of presentation where I, and I suspect you, can continually enter and find new beauty, new encouragement, new depth of understanding of how the world works. I've been chanting this weekly for, I don't know, 6 or 7 years, and I chanted a bunch before that, and I still, you know, I'll be chanting, and I go, wow, amazing. I never noticed that. Look, or sometimes I just, you know, make some sounds. There's nothing wrong with singing together. It's good. So, it's also, you know, it's not extremely technical. So I think there's some value for this, I get what I would call a nascent American Zen, for elevating this particular text, which I think might help to invite people into what we're doing in a simple way. Yeah. So, and as you may or may not know, it's not, as Taigen was saying, it's not been chanted traditionally in any Asian schools of Zen that I know of. It's not chanted in most Zen centers in the United States. So I kind of wrote this book because I was like, it would be great if just a few more people could enter the extraordinary beauty and depth of this text. And, you know, some texts, you know, we come from a culture where it's like you read a novel, and then you read another novel, and then you read another novel, and then you read another novel. A very linear relationship to text. But this text and liturgical texts in general, koans as well, they're designed to be really taken into your being and just come back over and over again and see if they can somehow permeate who you are. So this book is an invitation to let this permeate who you are. And, you know, my method of writing is I'm not a explainer, the explainer in chief. It's not what I'm trying to be here. I'm a relator. So I try to take the text into my heart and have some understanding, try and have some understanding of it as something outside of me, but ultimately really view the process of writing it as just a co-creation, moment to moment. So there are some sections of the book which are, you know, I do sort of say, well, you can see how this seems to be alluding to this specific body of Buddhist teaching, so more like classic exegesis. Ooh, big words. And then other times, you know, maybe I go a different way. We're doing a different kind of practice now. So I relate the text to the long 1500-year Buddhist history that preceded its creation, and the way that these teachings actually show up in my life and the lives of the people I practice with, my teacher and my friends at Minnesota Zen Meditation Center, who are living some aspect of this, because we are inspired by it. So I think I want to read a little bit of this book. So I got the first talk I gave about this. Basically, I showed up on a Sunday at Zen Center, and the person who was supposed to speak was not there for reasons I can't remember. But everyone looked around, and I was kind of like the most, I don't know, I'd been around longer or something. So why don't you give the talk? So I picked this poem up, and I gave a talk. And then afterwards, I realized, oh, I didn't get past the first line. So I did write three different chapters on the first line of this poem. I built a grasshopper where there's nothing of value. But I feel like I'm not the worst, because I'm pretty sure Red Pine, in his commentary on the Heart Sutra, actually does a whole chapter on the first letter. So anyway, this is one of three distinct chapters on the opening line. I've built a grass hut where there's nothing of value. It's called Living Lightly on the Land. Houses of wood were popular when this poem was written, and we still frame houses with wood today. They can stand for hundreds of years. Most of our houses these days have as their bones dead trees. Buildings made of stone, of course, last even longer. You can find stone structures in China and across the world that have been standing for thousands of years. Stone, though, must be quarried from the earth and transported with immense human effort. You can see the deep cuts made in the earth from quarrying for many, many years. Similarly, near my mother's mountain home, we drive through long stretches of clear-cut forest where stumps and low grass occupy a land once home to thousands of immense, old, and living beings. Grass, on the other hand, is quite a thing. Cut it, and it grows right back. Incredibly resilient, it is a basic wellspring of life for vast tracts of land across the earth where millions of grazers eat grass, and grass just keeps growing. Living in a grass hut is a way to avoid leaving big scars on the earth, to avoid laying waste to lots of life, but still have just enough protection while living with the renewable resources the land provides. Now, where I live, a grass home doesn't sound so good. Is there a state song from Minnesota? I don't know. The lovely summer months in Minnesota end. I know it's hard to believe. And the winter is very cold, with many feet of snowfall. People grimace as they fight the ice on their windshields of their cars, making only brief appearances in the outdoors, spending the rest of their time in the large buildings that are heated by petroleum products, dug from deep in the earth and transported halfway around the world, or in their 3,000-pound metal transportation devices powered by the same fuels. Grass hut, indeed. Sure, Shitu did not live in Minnesota. However, the Lakota and Ojibwe lived here for thousands of years with homes made of animal hide. These are people who saw constantly renewing abundance where we tend to see scarcity. In the summer, I take backpacking trips in the mountains with my family, and in the last few years, I've begun to bring people backpacking on silent meditation retreats. Cutting down on the things you have does something good for the mind. When you spend several days or weeks with the necessities of your life all in a single bag on your back, you get a little closer to the basics of life. You use less, and you know exactly what you're using. When you carry the garbage you create with you around for a few days until you leave the wilderness and put it in a garbage can, you see a basic truth. There is not really an away where you can throw things. You become a little more intimate with what you consume. When we spend time deep in the woods, we see how much more vast and dynamic nature is than anything we could construct. This also happens in Zazen. That was an aside. That should be. Okay. We also see how easy it would be for us to denude nature in order to extract the things we want. We see something whose preciousness is dependent on us letting it be. The earliest Buddhist monks lived very lightly on the land. They had no homes, they ate little, and they wore discarded rags. But these practices were not motivated by an altruistic love for the earth. The Buddha taught that renunciation of worldly goods was the best way to be free from suffering. Wanting and gaining material things is an extraordinarily ineffective means of promoting our welfare. But our culture keeps pushing us to do it. The results are not going well for the other species on our planet, and they are not going well for our children and grandchildren. How can we live in a way where we see that what the earth naturally and renewably provides is enough? How can we manifest the wisdom of living in a hut of grass that will blow away and grow right back? I live in a wood frame house, and I will be quite surprised if anyone reading this book decides to move into a grass hut. Although I'd be really excited, so let me know if you do. But this poem has encouraged me to look at what I consume and why. Changing my habits to consume less and have a less damaging impact on the world is a process. For me, I stopped eating meat a while back, shortly after I was ordained as a Zen priest. I choose not to do so not because of rules, but because I'm encouraged to be inquisitive about how my actions affect others. I get more vegetables from local farms. I keep looking for ways to walk and bike more and drive less. I'm not here to tell you what to do, but I encourage you to be attentive to what you're using and how it affects you and everything else. This poem's message of a life of ease starts with an image of relying on the renewable resources the world offers and letting go of all the fancy things we can buy. It is showing how little you need to be well. It's showing that abundance is here when we keep it simple, and scarcity is here when we want more. So this is my attempt to completely turn everyone off at the start. Because I think this theme, which is really pretty central to a lot of Buddhism, is not really central to American Buddhism. This theme of shedding material things. And like I say, you know, I got a house. I drove here in a car, so I'm not much of a preacher. But I'm continuing to investigate. How can we just look at, you know, when you want something, what's that feel like when you want to buy something? What's it feel like to actually have it? How many people have a smartphone and in the last week have been pissed off because the data wasn't coming fast enough? That's amazing. That's the triumph of human consciousness. Turning something completely incomprehensible 10 years ago into an expectation, and then poof, right into suffering. Amazing. Aren't we good at this? We're funny, but we can turn the light to shine within. We can have a look at actually how this feels, and just see if it begins to turn the way we are. So this whole thing is about, I mean, Shitu starts by saying, I'm living in this grass hut and I'm chilling out. Relax and enjoy a nap. Then he goes on to tell us to do the same thing, to let go, to open our hands, walk innocent, trust without doubt. He's not talking about trust in some kind of like idea. He's talking about a position, a heart level position of trusting what is. This is the trust of Mahayana Buddhism. Trusting not a conceptual position, but just ease. Ease. So, you know, we can't talk about this consumption stuff in the United States because people go, oh, you're taking away my stuff. But it's all about just having a better life. It's like, this works. This works. And this theme of ease is interwoven with another theme throughout this poem, which is has to do with selfhood. So there's shifting perspectives on what the self is within the poem. And then they're shifting, you know, as you chant it, you may find that it's kind of like, what is this hut? I wonder if it's just a hut or it's have some symbolic value, and what it, because it could have, if you start to look at it, it's like, is the hut the body? Is the hut the mind? Is the hut this particular thusness that we occupy? Can't really occupy thusness, but that's okay. No room for occupation. So this theme runs throughout this book, and I wrote a little chapter that deals with this in particular. So this is a response to the line, the person in the hut lives here calmly. The chapter is entitled, Who is this person? Who is this person? The person in the hut lives here calmly. In the first lines of this poem, we are given a first-person narrator. I've built a grass hut where there's nothing of value. After eating, I relax and enjoy a nap. Now we are told the person in the hut lives here calmly. So where did our first person go? Chinese is a language where ambiguity regarding pronouns can be very easily achieved. Do I have that right?
Definitely.
My Chinese is very small. But the Chinese characters in Shi Tzu's poem use specific language to move from the I to the person. So I'm left wondering, who is this person? Is it Shi Tzu? Is it a fictional mountain dweller? Is it me? Is it you? Is it all of us? Who is this person? In simplest terms, we could say that this moving from the first to the third person points to a letting go of attachment to the self. A big topic for the Buddha, which you probably know. One of his main insights was that he couldn't locate anything that actually was him, his, or his self. This is an observation with profound metaphysical implications that are celebrated in later Buddhist teachings. But what is most wonderful to me is the practicality of it. In the earliest records of Buddhism, he says that thinking that anything is you, yours, or yourself causes suffering through attachment and thus makes no sense. Unless you like suffering. That's an aside. He advises us to practice saying, this body is not me, this body is not mine, this body is not myself. This feeling is not me, this feeling is not mine, this feeling is not myself. This thought is not me, etc. He doesn't try and prove some fundamental truth about non-self. He just shows a practical means to be well, by shedding conceptions of selfhood. So moving from the first to the third person in this poem is about moving to a state of wellness, of calm abiding. And you know this, I teach introduction to Zen meditation for a long time, and it seems like one of the, well, the main thing is people say, I want to meditate and I don't do it. So that's the main thing I hear. But the second main thing I hear is people just noticing that they're thinking. And it's like, wow, that's cool. What a cool thing to know about. I mean, it's happening all the time and we didn't even know. Wow. So wonderful. And, you know, just noticing that it's happening is actually in this directionality of this thought is not me. Because suddenly you just see that there's this occurrence. And you know, a few things really, I mean, I don't know, something that can be very, very effective is just seeing that your feelings are not you. Because, you know, is it just me, or it's like when I'm really angry, somehow I'm more right? I become incredibly correct. So, you know, you say, I'm angry. But of course, normally you don't even say, I'm angry. I just say, you're wrong. And by seeing that it's just anger, It's not I'm angry. There's this, wow, what's happening? Oh, anger. What's this like? Oh. Then there's some room for curiosity, some questioning, some intimacy with the terrain of my experience. So this poem, at times in this book, I'm more specific about like types of teachings that Shih Tzu is alluding to. So I'll read you a section that's kind of like that. This is from a chapter called Everything's Included, a commentary on the line, though the hut is small, it includes the entire world. Autonomy and interdependence, alienation and connection. These are the key matters of though the hut is small, it includes the entire world. They are also the central themes in Huayan Buddhism, a school of thought and practice that arose in China fairly contemporaneously with Zen during the latter half of the first millennium. The emphasis of this school was the interpenetration or interdependence of all phenomena. The idea that all things are infinitely interconnected has been part of pretty much every type of Buddhism, but the Huayan school really made it the central pillar of understanding. In simplest terms, realizing our connection rather than our separation can be profoundly healing. Aren't the most painful times with your loved ones the ones where you feel most separate? However, separateness is not the only pitfall here. We can get lost in interdependence. We can lose our sense of personal authority, autonomy, and responsibility. We need to realize that we're both interdependent and autonomous, both together and apart. Huayan describes the world as being a fourfold realm, and the Chinese characters for these realms are the same ones Shih Tzu uses, translated here as the entire world. The teaching of the fourfold realm is quite complex, but in practical terms, it can be boiled down to, one, the fact that each thing is intimately connected to every other thing. Two, that each thing is an expression of the interdependence of everything else. Three, the whole universe is an expression of each individual thing. Four, and each thing is exactly itself. So, hey, could you repeat those back to me? That she said in which order. That should be on tape. In other words, everything is interdependent. Also, you are just the universe expressing itself. So you can relax a little bit. We don't know. We think, oh, God, I screwed everything up. Or, holy cow, am I good at this? Or, how am I going to get it all done? It's all doing itself. It's doing itself. It appears to be this little container looking out. It's just a tendency of consciousness to see the separation. Nothing more. Just a habit, like wanting coffee in the morning. It's kind of deeply ingrained, though. Third perspective on the Dharma Dhatu is that your actions have infinite impact. Your actions have infinite impact. If the whole universe is an expression of each thing, that means your momentary effort touches everything. And this is pretty simple. If everything's interconnected, how could there be a break between your momentary contribution to the universe and everything else? This means that you're in a position of enormous empowerment. The basic message of the first teaching of the Buddha is a message of empowerment. There's suffering in this world, and you can do something about it. You can do something, and it matters. Your life is not trivial. Central theme of Dogen's work, moment-to-moment engagement. Why? Because your momentary effort is infinite. Are you going to put in this moment into the world just another iteration of your karma, your conditioning? Or are you going to put in a manifestation of your vow to liberate all beings? I don't know. And I have no idea how you're going to manifest your vow. What does that even mean? We don't know. So we just keep coming back into the not knowing. Kind of a crazy practice, but it's kind of wonderful and mysterious. And if it takes the shape of just giving your friend a hug, that's pretty simple. That's maybe the best way to do your bodhisattva vow. And finally, in the fourfold Dharma Dhatu, we say each thing is simply itself. You are you. You are you. Just whatever you are. As Dogen says in the Genjo Koan, early on, when you first seek Dharma, you imagine that you are far away from its environs. Don't we feel that way? Oh, maybe someday I'm going to be as light as Titan. It's going to be cool. You imagine you're far away from its environs. But he says, Dharma is already correctly transmitted because you are immediately your original self. Immediate. Always, already. Just this, complete. It's always a joy to have the opportunity to share practice with people and allow us to be touched by Shitu's beautiful offering to the world. Just a guy. No one knew who he was at the time. He just made his little effort. He wrote a few things down. Now there's some beauty for us forever. We don't know. We just make our effort. So I'm really grateful to have had this opportunity to do this with you, and in particular for Taigen for inviting me to do it. And I would like to just offer some time for maybe people would like to offer reflections or questions. Anything? Words?
I just want to thank you for a really lovely presentation of pieces of grass from the grass hut. So please feel free to respond or add your comments or questions or engage with Ben. The other Ben.
So thanks a lot for your talk. I really like the song in the grass hut. And that first line especially I really like. And every time I hear it, it reminds me of something else. And so this is what it reminded me of just now. I'm a cultural anthropologist, and there's a famous argument that Marshall Solins makes about modern civilization versus hunters and gatherers. And he says that all people have to solve an equation between their needs and the resources that they have. And that what Western society has done is that it has exploited as many resources as possible, and it's put as much labor and technology and effort into extracting things from those resources. And I always tell my students, I always ask my students, what would be another way of going about this? And they look at me like I'm crazy. And they're like, better technology? They can't. And usually, eventually, one of them will raise their hand and say, maybe we should want less. And that's the argument that Solins makes, and the point that he makes, of course, is that, you know, hunter-gatherers solve this equation by wanting less, and what they gain is leisure. Mm-hmm. What they gain is time, and time to devote to all sorts of other things. So that was just my, I don't know, how that sparked with me right now. Thanks.
Thank you. I'd like to remark on the famous cultural anthropology paper where someone went down to hang out with the Kung Bushmen in southern Africa, which is like one of the most difficult deserts in the world to live in. Like they're eating these tiny nuts that are hard to get. And he's like, we're going to go down there and we're going to see how hard it is to do this. And it, basically, they work about 10 hours a week, and then they travel around visiting their families. Pretty good.
Other comments, please. Yes, Jen.
A group. It actually is based on Thomas Cleary's translation. It's based on Tom. That one's based on Thomas Cleary's translation. Cleary never translated this, as far as I know, though.
But this is yours. Okay. That's
with Kaz Ta-Nehisi, yes.
With whom?
Kaz Ta-Nehisi, who did that painting.
Oh, I see. So the two of you. Mm-hmm. I see. Okay. Thank you.
I want to add something about grass, just since you were mentioning those, the grasses on the dunes. That when he talks about a grass hut, we have an idea of grass because here we have lawns, you know, this kind of short, I don't know, like golf course, like these lots of grass with, you know, and it needs lots of water. And there's no, I don't think there's any such thing as lawns in Asia. That, so grasses just meant like wild grasses, weeds.
Yeah. That's what you get out of.
Yeah. So he's talking about prairie grasses, really. Yeah.
Yeah. They catch fire.
So. Ben generously gave us lots of time to just talk some
What can you say about wanting to know the undying person in the hub? Well, the line that follows the lines that you quoted, if, you know, the interpretation is going to be free from obstructions, is followed by, if you want to know the undying person, you have to separate from the skin bag in and out.
Yeah, well, the idea of Buddhism really is to become immortal. Sorry.
Oh.
I'm fooling. Yeah, so undying, it's pretty clear it's not dying, I think, in the Chinese. So, you know, to me, this appears to be shorthand for not dying also means not being born. So,
not being born.
Not born.
Born.
Yeah. Born. Yeah. So you often see paired. It's kind of a, you know, there's a really big calligraphy of this at Hokkyoji where I just was. No birth, no death, which comes directly from, I don't know the original origin of it, but in the dedicatory verse of Nagarjuna's fundamental verses on the middle way. It's just a few lines. One of them is no birth, no death, no coming, no going. So there's this invitation. If you want to know the undying person or not, so first, it's an invitation. Do you want to know this? And who is this person at this point? Back to this question. Who is the person in the hut? Is Shitu saying, maybe I'm Mr. Zen Master and I'm not coming and not going? Maybe. Or is he saying, what is it that is here in this hut? What is it that's here that's not coming and going? Because this idea that things come to be and pass away is a tendency of our consciousness to see. It looks like that to us because that's the way our consciousness functions. It's a momentary thingy. But ultimately, we don't know what the universe is. So we're like, I know what the universe is. It goes doot, doot, thing after thing after thing. But that's just the way our consciousness marks experience. So one, the line says, who is this person? Are you meeting yourself? Are you meeting Shitu? Are you meeting everything? And two, it says, the most fundamental thing you think about the way the universe works is not entirely true. So it's cracking open basic conceptions about the self and time, space and time. Because seeing through these conceptions makes space for us to feel connection. And when there's a profound connection, then there's room for peace that's not only within our heart, but also outflowing.
So could you talk a little bit about sort of the rediscovery of the Song of the Grass Hut? You know, it's not a chant that's typically chanted, and sort of how and why has it been rediscovered? Why did it drop out of regular practice?
I would probably have to defer everything. I mean, I could say something about this, but I think Taiga knows much more than I do, because I think basically you pulled it from obscurity. I mean, what were you looking through the, what's it called, the Taisho?
No, actually, so this, the harmony of difference and sameness, Sandokai, which we also chant regularly, maybe not as often, but that's also by Shuto, and quite well-known poem, important poem in terms of the philosophy of Soto Zen and presenting that in Jewelmare Samadhi as it comes out of that. But Shuto, I actually got this from looking at Zen Dust. I don't know if you know that. It's a book that's not in print, but a shorter version of it called the Zen Koan by Isshu Miura, who's a Japanese Zen master who taught in America. Was one of the people who did it along with Gary Snyder and Ruth Fuller Sasaki. And anyway, but it has lots of comprehensive notes. And somehow for Shuto, when I was looking him up, it mentioned that he also did this other poem. So I asked Kaz Tanahashi, well, where is this? What is it? And, you know, he found it. And anyway, so we translated it. So that's, you know, but why? But it's interesting because we all like it so much and we chant it so often, but it's not that it was totally obscure, because there are lines from it that appear in Hongzhe, there are lines from it that appear in Dogen, there are lines from it that appear in the Book of Serenity and in Blue Cliff Record. So those Zen people knew about it, but I've never seen any other specific reference to it. So anyway, we translated it, and I put it at the end of Cultivating the Empty Field, and I don't know how it got started to get chanted in Minnesota. Do you have any idea?
I don't. I can't. It's like a folklore, you know? It's like trying to find out who wrote Mary Had a Little Lamb.
Oh. Doesn't anybody know that?
So
this is a nursery rhyme.
Well, the folklore...
For Zen nurseries.
Yeah.
And the Mountain Source Sangha that I started in the Bay Area before I escaped from California and moved to Chicago, they chant it there. But other people in the Tsuki Rishi lineage don't chant it, as far as I know. And so I'm hoping that Ben's book will be a way of more people finding out about it. But so that's about as much as, you know, can be said, I think.
Thanks.
So, well, it's about our usual time of stopping, but does anybody have any last comment or question or just favorite line that you want to grill Ben on, or, you know, take
Could
a little
you say
more
time? Something about skin bag? I mean, that seems to be one of these things that comes up. I love that term, but it seems to arouse a lot of negativity in a lot of people. So I just wonder if you could discuss that.
Yeah. So one, some people I know they're like, it's funny. It's kind of a funny thing. You know, the poem is so evocative, and, you know, it's like we're in the mountains and I don't know anything. I'm just sitting with my head covered in this shiny window, below the green pines in a skin bag. So, you know, it's a turn, you know, in terms of narrative, if you look at a sonnet towards the end, it turns. It takes you somewhere. And he does that at the end, bring you home to you now. So it has that sense. But also, it pretty specifically refers to the Four Foundations of Mindfulness Sutra, which the first foundation of mindfulness, which is like really the basic meditation text of early Buddhism. The first foundation is mindfulness of body. You start by establishing mindfulness of the body through the breath. Sounds familiar. And then there's one other step I'm forgetting. And then you visualize your body as a bag of skin which holds nasty stuff. And it lists it. It's like excrement, organs, bile. It's negative. It's intended to be. So you say it brings up negativity. That is the point. So... And people go, oh, these early Buddhists with their anti-body thing. Well, there's a dialectic. So there's like a relational balancing between total intimacy with the body, but using cognitive tools like calling your body a skin bag to make it so you don't just turn that into attachment. Because the point isn't to just be like, ooh, I feel so good. It feels so good to be on the beach. I mean, if you are enjoying Beyond the Beach, completely enjoy being on the beach. And if you are in the rain, really cold, and it sucks, completely enjoy being in the rain and being really cold. So the skin bag language So he says, don't separate. So it's really, it's the first part of the first foundational mindfulness paired with the second. And so it is clearly referential as it could be, and yet so succinct and so immediate. So you don't need to know any of that. You just know, he just jarred me into something. Or when I chanted this, I jarred me into something. And what is it? Oh, it's just this. Just this is it.
Last week I was at a conference with a bunch of ecologists talking about large predators and whether they could come back to the city, and one of the speakers said, well, to a large predator, we're just bags of meat. And I thought that she's like, anyway. Yeah.
Yeah.
Don't separate from this bag of meat. wonderful. Well, Ben, thank you so much. That was really delicious. And I'm very, very happy to have you here. And thank you for doing this. We'll close, as we always do, with the four bodhisattva vows on the last, next to the last page of your chant book, and we chant those three times.
Beings are numberless. I vow to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them, but as ways unsurpassable, I vow to realize it. Beings are numberless. I vow to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to realize it. Beings are numberless. I vow to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I